It's always very strange when I come into a room and hear me speaking. I thought, oh, there's a ghost in here somewhere. Okay, welcome everybody, especially those who are sitting in the back there who come to listen to a Dharma talk. Okay, come on, we've got plenty of time. And those of you who are on the retreat here. So we're just going to wait until everything settles down. For these talks which I'm giving in the evening, this is especially for those guests here. They're all somehow to do with the meditation, but hopefully that they'll be useful for those people who are just coming in to listen to a Dharma talk. So sometimes when I give a Dharma talk in public, it's usually on all sorts of things concerned with daily life. But because this is a meditation retreat, most of the talks in the evening are somehow to do with meditation. Very good. So, just as I was coming in here, I was listening to myself on the talk there about the difference between being a spiritual director and being a spiritual dictator. So, even though that I'm a boss of a Buddhist society, that you never actually become a dictator. I always find the way to get your own way is to be able to use psychology. And it's the same psychology which I use to train my mind as I do to train my monks. Those of you who've got children, and those children, if they're misbehaving and you try to control them, it's just like having a mind which misbehaves in meditation. You try to control it. If you know psychology, you can train your children really, really well. For example, there was one family who told me that they could not get their son to go to the temple. Every time they said, come and listen to one of the monks at the temple. He said, no. So I told them, listen, this is what you should do. You go out in the evening, go to the temple, just don't tell your son where you're going. And when they say, Mom, Dad, where are you going? Say, none of your business. So why is it none of my business? Look, it's none of your business, be quiet. That's number one, to get them interested. And number two, if they find out, are you going to the temple? You say, yes. Son, you can't go. Prohibited. And when you tell your child, oh, you're banned from going to the temple. Why am I banned from going to the temple? Don't ask any question, you just can't go. And of course, their son went. It's reverse psychology. It's amazing, just you think it's quite simple, but it's amazing just how well that works, reverse psychology. That a year or two ago, there's one of our members, she was a very successful businesswoman and a very bright person. We wanted her on our committee. So I went up to talk with her and I said, you know, that it'd be very nice, we're having our committee elections soon. It'd be very good if you stand for one of the posts. And I thought actually I was thinking of getting her to be vice president. And she immediately said, now listen, I have to do so much work, I'm so busy. I can't even have time for my family, let alone doing any more work. It's just too busy. And of course, as soon as I heard her, I knew that if I followed on that particular path, I would never get her on our committee. So I said, oh look, I made a mistake, sorry. Now, I don't want you to even think about this, because I know that sometimes people feel guilty if they, you know, you ask by me for a good cause and you can't do it. I said, no look, you can't do it. In fact, I said, I'm banning you from even thinking about it. You can't be on our committee. Okay, don't even think about it. You're banned. And a few days later, it worked perfectly. She rang me up and said, why am I banned from being on your committee? And she became our vice president. It worked very easily. Because when you use reverse psychology, you know how to work with people. It's the same with when I was a young monk, I was the number two in our monastery. And so I had an abbot and one who is senior to me. And of course, when you've got a boss, either at work, or in the monastery, or in the family, you've got to be very smart and learn how to get your own way. So, how I learned to get my own way, even though I wasn't boss, I was a power behind the scenes, because I use psychology. The simile which I usually give was like, we were building our monastery, and so I go up to him and say, why don't we build a hut over there on the hill? I just make the suggestion very calmly, and he would say, don't be ridiculous, that's a stupid idea. No one will build a hut on the hill. Now with psychology, you do not argue with the boss. You use more devious means than arguing. So I said, oh, okay, yeah, very, very good. And I wouldn't push the point. I'd wait for 1 or 2 weeks when I was sure he'd forgotten. And then I'd say it again. Why do we build a hut on the hill? And he would say, oh, it's a silly idea. I don't think that would work. And I would leave it. Usually I'd only need 2 times. Sometimes 3 at most. But what would happen? Another couple of weeks would go past. And I'd be walking with him. And he said, I've just had this idea. We should build a hut on the hill up there. And I'd always say, wow, what a great idea of yours. Now, how this worked was as follows. And I'll now tell you how that works in meditation. How that works is, if it really is a good idea, all you need to do is to plant the seed. The problem is, people actually plant the seed just too fiercely. They hammer the seed home, and they destroy both the receptacle and the seed at the same time. You plant the seed. And whatever someone hears, they do actually remember. They cannot maybe recall it, but subconsciously, it's gone in. And all you do need is to give it time to germinate. Subconsciously, they'll be thinking about it. When they say, oh, it's a stupid idea, don't be ridiculous. That's not really true. That's just on the surface. That's their first reaction. But the seed has gone in. And they think about it. You maybe have to reinforce it 1 or 2 times at most. Why don't we build a hut on the hill? Subconsciously, they think about that. And if it really is a good idea, it appears to them as their idea. And that's the most important thing. Because bosses are very proud. And they want their ideas to appear as if it came from them. So the abbot would say, oh, why don't we, this is my idea, why don't we build a hut on the hill? Who cares whose idea it is, as long as I get my own way and you get the hut on the hill. And it always worked. And it appeared to them as it was their idea. So if you are number 2 in the office, or if you've got a husband who thinks he's controlling you, this is how to slip those ideas underneath his radar screen. And then he comes along and says, oh, I think it's a wonderful idea. I think it's my idea is a good idea. Let's give a donation to the temple or something. He says, oh, what a wonderful idea of yours, darling. Even though you knew it was your idea all along. Now that's actually also how we use our mind in meditation. How we control our mind. We give it some good suggestions. We don't have to force the mind. We give it a few suggestions and we let those suggestions germinate. If we're doing, say, breath meditation, we say, mind, why didn't you watch the breath? And sometimes, you know what it's like already, you say, that's a silly idea, says the brain or the mind. It doesn't cooperate. Leave it alone. Don't push it. And then, maybe a day later, suggest it again. Oh, mind, why didn't you watch the breath and be peaceful? Don't be ridiculous, says your mind, as it goes thinking about the past, sleeping, being restless or whatever, you can't do it. You've got to use psychology. Just make a suggestion. And after a while, you will find the mind wants to watch the breath. It wants to do it. You don't force it. The same way you use psychology to watch the breath, in meditation, so you use psychology to get your own way in life. The Sakadaji works both ways. Which is why we have to be kind in meditation. To be able to make it work. Why kindness and compassion and wisdom work in life. It's a good idea. It will germinate, grow, and come to fruition. And peace is a good idea in meditation. But do we really make peace in our meditation? There are two types of meditation. It's the subject of this evening's talk. The two types of meditation. And it's not samatha and vipassana. You all know that. This is a new type of two types. Actually, samatha and vipassana are the same. The two types of meditation are making peace meditation and making war meditation. Now, which type of meditation do you do? Is it making war on your body and war on your mind? As you sit up here and say, body, sit still, or else. Mind, be quiet. Be quiet. How many times have I told you? Be quiet. Have you made war, or have you made peace so far? If your meditation is a battleground, as I said yesterday, you will experience collateral damage. You will have headaches, you will have pain, you'll be despondent, you'll be fed up. You'll think, my goodness, this is my holiday. Why am I spending so much of my holiday time sitting here with a sore back, with a sore bottom, with a crazy mind? That only happens if you make war with your mind. You don't make war with your mind, you make peace with your mind. How can you expect to achieve peacefulness if all you do is fight battles? Trying to control your mind, get rid of all the things which you don't like. We have peaceful meditation, not war meditation. The Buddha was a pacifist. This is how we look at our mind, with compassion and peace. How can we make peace? We make peace by every moment, whatever we experience, we make peace with it. Whatever you experience, make peace with it. If you're making peace, you're making the good karma of peace for the future. If you're making war, you're battling, you will never get peace that way, you'll only get more disturbance. So every moment in your meditation becomes a moment of making peace. Making peace with this moment, making peace with this moment, making peace with this moment. For all you meditators who have come to me in the interview time and say you've been tired, you've been sleepy, so have I. Out of compassion, out of empathy for you, I was also sleepy this afternoon. Now what do we mean there? Why? It was because of causes and effects. I've been very busy in Singapore giving lots and lots of talks. Even, it's very hard being a monk, you know. Because you give a talk, someone offers to drive you to the talk. On the way, they ask all their questions. As soon as you get in to the hall, people, even before you can sit down, they come up to you and say, can I ask a question? And afterwards you have question time, and on the way out, as they escort you to the car, they ask you their questions. Even when you're stuck in the lift going down to the bottom of the ground floor, they're asking you questions. And they always say, just one more question. When I say just one more question, hang on, there'll be two or three for sure. And if they don't ask me a question at the time, they hand me these slips of paper with their questions on. So it's a lot of hard work being a monk. No wonder I'm tired. It's nature, it's not my fault. So if you're tired in the first few days, it's not your fault. Make peace with your tiredness. For those of you who are tired, I love to tell this story. The Buddha was walking in the forest with Ananda, his chief disciple. No, one of his chief disciples, his attendant, sorry. And as he was walking through the forest, he saw a monk by the edge of the forest, sitting absolutely straight. His posture was perfect. And the Buddha turned around to Ananda and said, "I'm worried about him." And the Ananda can say, "Why? Wait and see." And of course, 1 or 2 weeks later, that monk had disrobed and got married. When he went deeper into the forest, he saw another monk who was nodding this way and nodding that way, really sloth and lots of torpor, very sleepy. And the Buddha turned around to Ananda and smiled. "So I'm not worried about him." In 2 weeks, he was fully enlightened. So all of those of you who are sleepy this afternoon, who knows, maybe in a couple of weeks, you could be fully enlightened. Look, you know, one of the famous sleepy monks in the time of the Buddha was Mahamoggallana. It was in the sutras, the Buddha caught him nodding. He was sleepy, and he became, you know, one of the foremost monks in psychic powers. Oh, all you people who are sleepy this afternoon, you could be developing psychic powers soon. And actually the reason why is, I've got another glass, my goodness. Look at these, huge. Honey, yeah. I know that I usually have small cups, but because this is a Mahayana temple, we've got big vehicle cups. Anyway, who cares anyway? Anyway, so the reason is that when the Buddha saw that first monk who was so stiff, he was perfect posture, but he was a control freak. Now you can make yourself look very, very mindful. You can look mindful, you can appear mindful, you can look like you're doing the meditation, but it's just control, control, control. That type of control freak on the outside looks, wow, look at her, she sits so straight, so strong, but it's all control. It's not coming from the right place. And because if you're a control freak, you'll never get any peace, never any happiness, you're making war with every moment. You're making war with your body. You know what happens when you make war with your body in meditation? You get samadhi headache. Which many people get here in meditation because they make war. They're trying too hard. I don't know if I told this story, but there's a man who went into a psychiatrist. He had this very, very terrible psychosis or phobia or whatever you call it. But he was really crazy. He said, "Doctor, sometimes I think I'm a marquee. Sometimes I think I'm a teepee." And the doctor said, "What? A marquee? A teepee?" He hadn't read that in his books. He hadn't heard that syndrome at the university. Someone who imagines they're a teepee half the time, and the other time they think they're a marquee. And he had a moment of insight. He said, "I've got it. I know your problem. You are too tense." Got it? Yeah. So don't be tense in meditation. Be relaxed. Yeah, a marquee is a type of tent. A teepee is what the Red Indians, the indigenous Indians of the United States, used to use as their tents. The two T-E-N-T-S. And T-E-N-S-E is also means you're too tight. So this is what happens when we get too tense. We never find any peace at all. The other monk, yeah, he was relaxing. He was getting sleepy, but it's only a matter of time before your sleepiness disappears. The sleepiness comes because of causes, because people have been working so hard. In Western psychology, it's called sleep deficit. and now you've got time to make up for the sleep. Because you know what it's like in the world? You've got to get up early in the morning to get the kids ready for school. You've got to go to work. You've got to clean the house up. You've got to drive through the heavy traffic. You get to work and you've got to work really hard. Sometimes you don't have time for lunch. And you have to work hard in the afternoon, and that's being a monk, let alone being a layperson in the world. We all have to work really hard, and no wonder we get tired. And now you're letting go. You're relaxing. You will experience tiredness on the first few days of a retreat. It's acceptable. It's allowable. When I gave you the eight precepts, we chanted the eight precepts this morning, there was not a precept said I shall refrain from nodding. That's not part of the precepts. So it is all right. It happens naturally because you're tired, but because this is a peaceful place, because you don't have to work on the computer, you don't have to use your mobile phone, you don't have to drive through the traffic, except to the breakfast tables, because there's many traffic there when you have to rush to get the breakfast in the morning. Because of that, eventually you get your energy back. Give yourself time. Allow nature just to work its way out. We flow, we let go according to life. And that way, we always will be able to develop good states of mind. I gave a wonderful story about letting go in my book, which came from one of my fellow monks. It's a great story because it showed actually how relaxing at the right time and place can actually save your life. He was a New Zealand monk, and he was with an old school friend, a university friend, I can't remember which, and he was hiking in New Zealand. If any of you have ever been to New Zealand, they've got lots of beautiful open spaces. When I first saw those open spaces, you know, the mountains and lakes, many, many places you can go, they call it tramping, just their word, like hiking, walking in the wilderness. I thought it looked so beautiful in the photographs. It looked just so delightful, almost paradise. But when I went there, I found a thing which you couldn't see in the photographs was the sand flies, like little mosquitoes, who kept biting you and biting you and biting you. They were so vicious in those wilderness. And the tourist brochures never told you about the sand flies. But anyway, he was walking with his friend in the wilderness. And after walking all day in the afternoon, they came to a beach. It was a very warm, summery day. So having walked all day, they were sweaty, they were tired. And there's just this beautiful stretch of beach with this blue ocean. And he couldn't resist it. So take off all his robes and go for a swim. Now you're not supposed to go for a swim for pleasure. And perhaps this is one of the reasons. Because as soon as he got into the water and started swimming, he got caught in one of these riptides. These currents, which actually many people get killed. And that was one of the very dangerous beaches. Because once you're in this current, it's incredible, it's much stronger than you are, and it carries you out a long way from the beach. He got caught in one of these very strong currents. But because he was a monk, he knew what to do. He relaxed and let go. He didn't even try to swim against that current. He completely relaxed. Now that took a lot of courage, because that current took him a long way from the shore, many hundreds of meters. And when that rip tide, started losing its force, as it does when it goes out, only when it started losing its force did he start to swim. Swim away from the current and towards the shore. He was such a long way out, he said, when he started swimming, that he actually did make it to the beach, and he was absolutely exhausted. He used every last ounce of his energy to get back. But he told me and understood that what he was telling was the truth. if he had tried to fight the current, he'd have still been taken out to the same distance. Maybe it took more time. And when he got out to the same distance, he would have been utterly exhausted. He would not have had the energy to swim back. He said letting go, literally going with the flow, saved his life. When there's a current you can't fight, you let go, you give in, you go with the flow. That happens so often in our life. In our meditation, if you're tired, you have to just go with the flow. Be tired. It will disappear after a short while. In fact, the more you struggle, the more you use up your energy, which means the longer the sleepiness lasts. I say, if you're sleepy, then sleep. Get it out and done with. It's cause and effect. It's nature. It's because you're out of energy. If your car hasn't got any gas, of course it won't go. So you just fill up with gas. You get some more petrol, that's all. And you get the petrol, the energy of the mind, by just being still. It comes back all by itself. So you go with the flow, which is making peace in every moment. It's the same in life if someone starts arguing with you. What do? Do you try and fight that current of somebody else? They argue with you, just go with the flow. They want to argue? They can. It's all right with me. They argue or get with me. It doesn't affect me. They're the one who gets hoarse. You know, there's a lovely story actually from Christianity. Of all the Christian traditions, the one which actually is closest to Buddhism is the Franciscans. Because actually they don't have money, or at least in the early years they didn't have any money, and they went for alms food. And this particular story, there was this one of these monks in the early days of the Franciscan order, and he was just so generous. So he was walking in the town for alms food, and this very, very poor man asked him for alms. And the monk said, I don't have anything. I don't have any money. All I've got is my robe. And the poor man said, okay, that'll do. And this was such a generous monk that he said, okay. And he gave him his robe. I don't know if I would do that. Would you do that, Mangala? Because when he got back to his monastery, he was naked. Now that's real generosity. You give everything. I mean, literally everything. So when he got back to his temple, his monastery, he was naked. He knocked on the door, and the other monk said, get away, we don't have any crazy naked people in this monastery. He said, it's me! And when they sort of said, hey, it's our monk. So what happened? Did he get robbed? Did he get assaulted? And so they took him inside, they gave him a new robe, and he said what had happened. That a very, very poor person had asked him for something. The only thing he had to give was his robe. So he was generous. He was that generous he even gave the only thing he owned, his robe. And all the monks said, now that's real generosity. That's actually what a monk should do. Someone's really poor, you can have my robe. I don't know if I'd get away with that in Malaysia, because I might be into big trouble. But nevertheless, they thought, well, you know, we can respect that. That's a wonderful thing to do. The problem was that it must be like the grapevine of the poor people in that town. But word soon got around that that monk was a very soft touch. So the next day, someone else asked him, can you give me something? I haven't got anything. I only got this robe. I was just given yesterday. That'll do. So the second time, he gave his robe away and came back to the monastery naked. And the other monk said, oh, here he comes again. So, okay, come inside, we'll give you another robe. And it happened three times. When he came back the third time, absolutely naked, they gave him a new robe and the abbot said, come into my office. And the abbot gave him a real scolding. Say, look, it's all right to be generous. We've only got so many robes in our storeroom, and these are all donated by our lay supporters. We can't keep giving everything away to poor people. Anyway, the word's probably got around. They're just taking you for a fool. They probably don't need a robe, but they said, this monk is so stupid, he'll give you anything. So he gave him a real scolding. Now, even though this abbot was scolding and scolding this monk never once tried to defend himself. He just looked to the ground with humility, and he accepted the whole scolding. And when the abbot was finished, he said, go. And he went. About 15 or 20 minutes later, this monk knocked on the abbot's door and asked to come in. Come in, what do you want? And he had a cup of soup, of hot soup. What you brought me hot soup for? Said the abbot. The way you were shouting at me, I'm sure you've got a sore throat. This is for your throat. And he wasn't trying to be clever. He was really compassionate. When he was being scolded, he never thought of himself for one moment. He only thought of that poor fellow shouting and making his throat sore. That's the only thing he thought of. And so when he was released, he thought, I must help that person with a sore throat. So, the next time your husband scolds you, take it peacefully and then go and get him a bowl of soup. Then why do you get upset when people scold us? If you've been doing anything wrong, you know you've done something wrong. If they're shouting at you, you haven't done anything wrong, there's no problem to get upset. In fact, you should be compassionate like that monk. Oh, that poor person has scolded me so much. Let's get him some of these sweets, which are good for the throat. The point is that when other people scold us, we allow them to take away our peace and happiness. They become like a thief. We allow them into our mind, into our heart, to take away all our joy, all our peace. We don't need to do that. Whatever another person says, no matter how cruel or harsh it is, you don't need to allow them to steal your happiness. You lock up your doors of your house. You never allow anyone to take your peace and happiness. That is yours. That's precious. So they can say whatever they like to you. If they scold you, shout at you, you should always remember this story. A long time ago, there was a man who had the afternoon off work. And his wife was very, very busy cooking the dinner. And she said, husband, I'm short of eggs. I need some eggs for the meal. And I'm so busy, you've got nothing to do. Would you mind going to the market and getting some eggs for me? He said, sure, I don't mind. And so the wife gave her husband a basket and some money. And she gave him the instructions of where the market was and how many eggs she needed. Now, he'd never been in the market ever before. But he went. As soon as he reached the market, as soon as he entered the market, this young man came up to him and said, sir, you've got a face like a camel. What? I don't even know you. And you've got a voice like a dog. What are you saying? And, now those are actually the polite things he said. As a monk, I cannot go any further. He said some awful, terrible, rude things to this husband. And in front of everybody, he said, I don't even know you. I've never seen you before. Why do you say such things? That never stopped the young man. And the young man gave him such a scolding, such a volley of abuse, some even really awful, crude, disgusting things he said to this husband. The husband turned around and went home. When he went back inside his house, his wife said, you're early, dear. Did you get the eggs? No. And I never want to go to that stupid market ever again. Don't send me there. Now, those of you who've got husbands, you know, when your husband's like that, you have to sort of like stroke him to calm him down. It's a waste of time arguing with they're crazy. So, She talked to him very nicely, very gently, until he calmed down. Once he calmed down, she could get some sense out of him. So she asked him, "What happened?" He said, "Well, I went into that market and this young man came and he called me all these terrible names. I couldn't even say those words to you, what he called me. And I don't even know him. It's so unfair." And the wife said, "What did he look like?" And the husband described the young man, and the wife recognized him immediately. "Oh, it's him. That poor young man, when he was a boy, he fell over and hit his head. He's actually crazy. He's mad. He had to stop going to school. He will never get a wife. He can't get a job because he's crazy. He just hangs around the market all day. Sometimes he swears at me and calls me names. Sometimes somebody else. We tolerate him because the poor young man is crazy." And as soon as the husband heard that, it was because this boy was crazy. He thought, "Ah, never mind. He didn't really mean it. He's just, loopy, that's all." So the wife said, "Now, I really do need those eggs. Could you really go back and get those eggs for me? Don't mind about that boy, he's crazy." And of course, once he realized the boy was crazy, he lost all of his anger, all of his being upset about being abused. So he went back to that market with a basket with the money, and the young man saw him again and came and called him camel face, dog breath, everything. But this time it didn't matter. He went to the store for the eggs, the young man followed him and called him terrible names. The woman behind the counter said, "Don't worry about him, he hit his head when he was young." "Yeah, I just heard, poor fellow." And because he knew the boy was crazy, he could buy the eggs, endure all the abuse, walk out the market and come back home. Now that's the difference. If someone abuses us and calls us name, we realize they're crazy, it doesn't matter, does it? So the next time your husband calls you names, he's crazy. He must have hit his head that morning. Next time your wife scolds you, she's loopy. And it's true. It's called temporary insanity. Anger is temporary insanity. That's all it is. If you get angry at someone else, you're not smart, you're not wise, you're not in your right mind. You're crazy. So when someone's angry at you, it's temporary insanity. You leave it alone. You don't fight it. You just make peace with it. You say, "Oh, you poor thing that you call me such names." That's called compassion. And that works just the same with your meditation. If your mind is thinking all over the place, restless, it's a crazy mind. Why worry about your crazy mind? "Oh, you poor crazy mind. You must have hit your head somewhere this morning when you woke up." You make peace with it. You leave it alone. And by its nature, it will settle down by itself eventually. That's why when people come on a meditation retreat like this, 9 days, sometimes you get inspired and you have a good meditation and then you get despondent because it's not working. I've taught so many meditation retreats already. I know that don't even worry about all this judging yourself. You're going well, you're not going well. It happens despite you. Little by little, you'll calm down. Little by little, your restless mind will just stop being restless. The sleepiness will disappear. And you think, "Oh, look at me, I've got rid of sleepiness. Look at me, I've got rid of my restless mind." It's not you at all. It's just cause and effect, just the whole way this retreat runs. It's because of the retreat you get quiet. It's because of me. I've been brainwashing you, and I'm brainwashing you now. It's strange, actually. I like the idea of brainwashing because it's true. What you say, as I began in the morning, you think that you're in control of this, but you're not, because I give you suggestions to let go, just watch your breath. It's because I tell you to. That's why you watch it. Remember what I said at the beginning? I told my abbot years ago, "Why do we build a hut over there?" He said, "That's a stupid idea, don't do it." All the time I said, "Why do we do this meditation? That's stupid." But eventually you do it. I get my way. I know psychology. You'll get peace. I get my way. I know psychology. You'll get peaceful despite yourself. So the two types of meditation, we're supposed to be talking about two types of meditation. It's not samatha vipassana. It's battle meditation, war meditation, and peaceful meditation. So if you make peace with every moment, you'll find that peace grows. It's like the states of deep meditation are like a house built of many, many bricks. And each brick is a moment of peace. A moment of peace, a moment of peace, a moment of peace. And you build up until you've got so much peace, you are at peace. Not at peace, you are peace. And a wonderful thing happens in the deep meditations. It happens despite you. You just become the passenger. And you watch all these wonderful states of meditation. They just roll on and on and on. Despite you, you're just a passenger. Think, wow, look at this, this is happening. Who did that? It wasn't you. Because in meditation, you can't do meditation at all. You have to get out of the way and let meditation happen. Of the five hindrances, you know the five hindrances in meditation? There's a sixth hindrance. The sixth hindrance is you. You are the hindrance. Me, the controller, I want this, I want that. Measuring. You know, this is a Mahayana temple. There's a wonderful sutra, the third patriarch of Zen. He did this wonderful teaching. And it begins with, I think the path is easy for those who have no preferences. Or something like that. That's one of the translations I remember. The meditation is easy when you have no preferences. When you don't mind if you're crazy or if you're peaceful. If you don't try to get deep in meditation. When you don't have any preferences of being sleepy or being in jhana. You know what I mean there? It's the craving and the doing which causes all the trouble. Instead, we do the opposite, which is letting go, making peace. Many of you know the Four Noble Truths. Many of you know the Third Noble Truth, which is letting go of craving leads to nirvana, leads to peace. But many of you have probably not had that explained in full. Because the Buddha taught four ways of letting go. Which is in the Third Noble Truth. In the Third Noble Truth, the way the Buddha first taught it and always taught it, he said there's four types of letting go. In Pali, Chaga, Patinisaka, Muti and Malaya. When he said it's getting rid of this craving, that is Chaga, Patinisaka, Muti and Malaya. That's the way to Nibbana, he said. It's also the way to meditation. Because meditation is the path to Nibbana. So what are those four words? It really means giving, renouncing, freeing, and analia means, it means like non-attaching. But I'll give a deeper meaning of that in a few moments. This is the four ways of letting go. And this is the correct way of meditation. Chaga is generosity, it's giving. But by that, I don't mean giving ang paos. You don't bribe your way to deep meditation. Giving, what is actually generosity anyway? If you give a donation and you expect your name to be put on the big board there, is that real giving? If you give a donation expecting to get an honor in return, if you give a donation, expecting even to get good karma back, is that real giving, or is that doing business? I say it's doing business, it's not real giving. Giving should really be like anonymous. So you just give something and no one sees it. Some people do that, you know, they give the young pal, there's nothing in it.
It looks good.
It happens, I see that. Now, real giving is anonymous. You don't expect anything back. You don't even expect a thanks. Those of you who give and help someone is to get so disappointed, they never even thank me. Said you, because you never really gave. If it's real giving, you don't expect anything back at all. Now you understand why it's called letting go. If you give yourself to the meditation and you don't expect anything back at all, that's called letting go. How many of you have got expectations of what you want to achieve on this retreat? You've already figured out, I'm coming here because I want jhana, I want stream winning, I want enlightenment, otherwise I'm going to demand my money back. At least I want to get better meditation, I want to get peaceful, I want. That, it never works. In meditation it has to be real giving. So every time I sit down, meditation, I give, I don't expect anything at all. I'm giving my time to meditation out of faith in the Buddha. So what the Buddha asked me to do, whether it works or doesn't work, I don't care. Because the Buddha asked me to, I'm giving this out of faith in my teacher. You sit down and give yourself fully to this moment, not expecting anything at all. That's having no preference. That's why it becomes very easy. That's why you don't ever complain to me or the organizers. Sometimes, you know, it's noisy when you're meditating. Or when you're sleeping. Have you found out who the big snorer is in your room yet? If it is, put their name down on a piece of paper. We'll move them into the snoring room. Put all the snorers together. No, you can't do that. The snorer doesn't disturb you. And I'll tell you why. Years ago, when I was with my teacher Ajahn Chah in Thailand, you'd think that in those monasteries, in a traditional Buddhist culture, they would respect the monasteries. They did most of the time, but sometimes they had a party, and they respected the party much more than they respected Buddhism. In other words, they turned up the speakers really loud, and they were blaring. Even though the village was over a kilometer from our monastery, and you were inside your hut, it was like having, you know, the ghetto blaster right inside your room. It was so loud. Worse, I didn't enjoy that music. And so, we complained to Ajahn Chah, because they wouldn't listen to us. But you know, Ajahn Chah was a very powerful, respected monk. We said, Ajahn Chah, can you speak to those villagers to turn down the music when they have a party? They listen to you. I'm sure they do that because it's so disturbing to our meditation. And Ajahn Chah gave this beautiful, profound teaching like he normally did. These wonderful one-liners which you can apply to so many things. He said, it's not that the noise is disturbing you. You are disturbing the noise. Now wasn't that brilliant? And it's so absolutely correct. When someone is snoring in your room, it's not they're disturbing you, you're disturbing the snoring. Do you understand? You say, oh, why are they snoring so much? They shouldn't snore. We should, you know, just have a blacklist of snorers so they never come on a retreat ever again. That's not the case. The more you think about it, the more you're disturbing the noise. The biggest noise is not the snoring. The biggest noise is the complaining inside. That's the noise which keeps you awake, not the noise coming from their throat or their nose or wherever it's coming from. And it's true. That's what he meant by you're disturbing the noise. The noise is nature. It's a nature of people to snore. It's a nature of people to make a noise when they get up and get down. What do you expect? It's just like when you complain about your husband. It's not your husband disturbs you. You disturb the husband. What do you expect from a husband? They're all the same. I'm an expert on this because when the wives come and complain, they complain to their husband to me. And I've got all this data about what husband. You only know one husband. I know heaps of husbands. Because the wives always tell me about them. It's just a husband, that's all. Or you complain about your kids. You know, when I first was a monk, you used to have these interviews or counselling. And it was really interesting at first. I said, well, this is interesting. The second person came in, and I said, I've heard this before somewhere. The third person, here we go again. Always the same problems. So I know about kids. I know about husbands and wives. I know about parents. I know about sickness. You are disturbing the world. The world doesn't disturb you. This is nature. Old age, sickness and death, not getting what you want, getting what you don't want. That's nature. Stop disturbing nature. Stop disturbing the Dhamma. So you give, expecting nothing back in return. You don't disturb the world. You just give. And if you can do that, give yourself fully to the breath. Not expecting to get peaceful. Not expecting to get still. You will find you're letting go. And you go boom, 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 all the way to jhana and to nirvana. Easy. And if you come and say, I tried the Ajahn Brahm, it didn't work. What do you mean? I never promised it worked. You're doing, you're giving it, not expecting anything. You'll be expecting again, silly. So that's the first type of letting go. Giving, expecting nothing back in return. And in your life, those of you who've got children, isn't that what you do? You give to your kids. You don't expect them to be doctors or engineers or to pass their degrees. You just give to them. But you don't demand that they turn out to be this way or that way. So please be kind and giving to your children. Don't demand that they become models, sort of brilliant people. Not everyone can go to university. There's not enough places in university. In fact, actually, I read an article from England that because there's so many university graduates in UK, and there's not enough plumbers, you can make far more money doing plumbing than you can having a PhD in engineering. It's true. It's just market forces, demand, sales, demand and availability, supply and demand. So if you really want your kid to have a good career, then take him out of university, teach him how to be a plumber. And not only will you save a lot of money with university fees, but also you'll make much more money. And number three, you can help fix up the plumbing in Champaka Buddhist Lodge. So the point is, we give to our kids, but we really shouldn't expect much. And if you don't expect anything, you don't demand anything, you usually get everything back in return. If you want it, expect it, it never comes. So that's expectation. The second part of letting go is called renunciation. Patinisaga. You renounce things. So, see how much you can renounce. See how much you can throw away in your meditation. So often what happens is we get so far in meditation we can't go any further. We get stuck. You know what you should do when you get stuck in meditation? Have a look to see what you can throw away. There's something in there. I like to give the simile of a hot air balloon. I don't know if you've seen hot air balloons in Malaysia, but these are these big balloons. They have to use gas or like hot air, and there's a basket underneath with two or three people. You go really high up into the air. And because it's got no engines, it's very, very peaceful. It's like floating up where the birds live. And it's like, meditation is like going up into a hot air balloon, leaving the world right down there, and you're really high up where it's nice and peaceful. However, You get so far in your hot air balloon, you can't go any further. It's like you're meditating, you get to such a level, you can't go any further. So what would you do in a balloon? You'd see if there's any ballast, anything you can throw out of the basket of the balloon to make it lighter, so you can rise higher. And that's exactly what you do in meditation. You see, what can I throw out? As I said this morning, the first thing you throw out in your meditation is time. Don't be so concerned of whether it's... What day is it today anyway? Saturday? Sunday? Monday? What day is it today? No, it's not. It's now day. Today is now day. Now day of the now month. Now thousand, now hundred, and nowty now. And what time is it? It's now minutes past now. And so, isn't that true? What does it mean about time? January, February, 2000 and this, and 700 and that. It's only this conventional reality. So we throw away time. Are you a person, you meditators, who's trying to beat your record of how long you can sit meditation? I've done 40 minutes. I'm going to do 45 minutes now. 45 minutes, I'm going to do 50. 50, 60. I'm going to get into the Guinness Book of Records. The longest meditator. That's not the way to meditate. Ajahn Chah once said, because people thought that the longer you sit still, the more enlightened you'd be. So he gave the simile of the chickens. He said, if that was the case, that sitting still for many hours meant you're enlightened, he said, many chickens would be enlightened by now because they sit so still on their eggs. Are you a chicken meditator? I'm thinking the longer you sit, the more enlightened you're going to be. It doesn't matter. It's the quality of your meditation. If it's 5 minutes, but it's really peaceful and good, great. That's much better than 3 hours sitting there pushing through painless and trying to beat your record. That's not meditating. So you try and throw away time. You don't care whether it's 5 minutes, 5 hours, 50 hours. You just sit there. If it's peaceful, carry on. Don't count the clock. Also, don't count the days. Sometimes people think that way. Well, it's Saturday today. One day down, eight to go. That's really silly, isn't it? I remember I was a school teacher before I became a monk. And this school teacher came up to me once. I think it was the middle term. It was about 5 or 6 months of the job to go. He'd just got another job in the tax office. It was supposed to be a very good job. He got that job, but he had to finish his contract for that year before he could change jobs. He came up to me once, he said, I just caught myself wishing away 6 months of my life. Wishing it away to get rid of this job as a teacher so he can get the next job. That's a lot of your life to wish away. 6 months. 8 days is too much to wish away. Even 1 minute is too much to wish away. So don't try and get rid of this to get somewhere else. This moment is important. So the first thing you throw out of your basket is time. The next thing you throw out is thinking. Thinking weighs you down. Thinking is just so heavy. I gave this simile to my capia in Singapore. I said, when you're thinking, it's not really you thinking. What's actually happened? All these thoughts inside. What's actually happened? When you were sleeping last night, these two little tiny demons, these little imps, they crawled in. One crawled in your right ear, one crawled in your left ear, and they're having a conversation inside your head. And that's all this ba 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 inside. Two little demons. That's what thought is. So it actually worked for him. He said it's a great simile because he stopped listening to this little conversation going on inside his head. It wasn't his. Not me, not mine, anatta. There's two little demons inside your head. That's all it was. So when it's two little imps, two little demons, they are, shut up. When you don't listen to it, when you ignore it, it stops. So what happens? If it's your wife, nag, 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 nag. When you stop listening to it, you really ignore it. There's not much point nagging anymore. She stops. You know that sometimes people actually, these days, sometimes the husbands have to go overseas or the wives have to go to see their parents. So especially if the husbands have to be apart from their wives. You know the husbands sometimes miss you? I don't know if you left your husband at home to come actually here to the retreat. So out of compassion, what you can do for your husband is get a CD or one of these tapes and go, ma, 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 ma. I call it a nagging tape. So if he really misses you, he can put on the nagging tape or the nagging CD. Ma, 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 ma. So he'd never get lonely while you're away. So anyway, that's that nagger inside of you. Always complaining. If it hurt the way you think, it's always, you're not good enough, try harder, watch your breath more, don't be so lazy, sit longer, sit straight, don't go sleepy, get up earlier, don't think in this, nag, 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 nag. Those two little imps inside of you. So you tell them to shut up, throw them out of the basket. When you throw them out of the basket goes higher. It goes into beautiful silence. Silence is so wonderful. When everything inside stops. Then you can really listen. I call this total listening. Total listening is when you're silent in the moment. Then you can really hear what's going on. Without anything standing between you and the experience. No sound, no noting, no thoughts. You're really listening. It's like if you're in a concert. I don't know if you like classical music. If you go to a classical music concert, everybody is listening intently. Imagine you're at a concert and you turn around to your friend and say, that was a really nice piece of music when it's still going on. People say, shut up! And if you did it twice, you'd get thrown out. Why is it we do that when we're meditating? We've got the beautiful Buddha symphony. Or if I'm giving the talk, it's Brahms symphony. So why are you interrupting this classical talk? Shh. And listen fully. In silence. And then it's called total listening. That's what happens when you start. It's beautiful. And you hear so much. You've learned so much. Even when you go for dinner. I don't know if you're going to celebrate your enlightenment when you finish this retreat by going to an expensive restaurant. Have you ever gone to an expensive restaurant? And you look at the cost of the food, it's just so expensive. Listen, if you pay all that money for delicious food, please tell your partner to shut up while you're eating. So you can have full awareness of all those tastes. Because when they're talking to you, you can't taste the food, you listen to them, and all that money you're spending is just going down the drain. So look, this is expensive food, shut up, I want to really taste every bit of this. So, you should only talk to your friend or your partner when you go to cheap restaurants. To take your mind away from the rotten food. It's called total listening. Now, that's what you throw out the basket, all this talking business. And you go, hi. The next thing you've got to throw out is the body and the five senses. It's as if you're in this basket, you've thrown away almost everything. You look around that basket, what else can I throw out? It takes you to go higher. And you realize, I've got to throw out the basket. Your body and your senses. Many of you, I look at you, are very old. You are basket cases. So, throw away you, or rather your body. And this is the next thing you do in your meditation. Don't worry about the itch, the ache, the pain. Just, it's not mine. Throw it away. Leave it alone. So it disappears. In this meditation, your hands disappear, your legs disappear, your body disappears, your head disappears. You've got no sensation in your body at all. That's the only time you're free of the burden of a body. Otherwise, you're yawning, you're moving your hands, you're scratching your mouth. I'm just looking at what you're doing. You're rubbing your eyes. You're rubbing your cheek over there. But you just rub your nose, I saw you. Why do you do this? It's because your body is never comfortable. You try not moving your hands for 5 minutes. Go on, try. You won't be able to. As soon as you forget, you start moving again. There you started again. You did your glasses. You wiping your ear. You rub your nose again. The point is, this body is always irritating. The only time you have some peace with this body is, even if you're asleep, you don't get any peace. You have to toss this way, turn that way. The only time you have any peace is when you disengage from this body. In meditation, the body disappears. Oh, that's so nice. That's why you can actually see, like monks or meditators, sitting absolutely still for hours. Some years ago, we took a video of this monk meditating. What we did, we put it on fast forward. It's really good, because if there's any movement in the body, it really shows up on fast forward. And this was very impressive. On fast forward, that monk was as still as if it was on pause. He wasn't moving at all. That's impressive. Now what actually that means, how can you do that? He wasn't holding his body still. He let it go and it was still all by itself. And that is so pleasant not to have to worry about this body. That's the next thing, you go very high. What's the last thing you let go of? You've thrown away the basket, you're hanging on to the balloon. How can you go higher? Ah, you understand the last thing you have to let go of in meditation is you. You've got to throw you out. And once you throw you out, then the balloon goes all the way to Nibbana. Anatta. That's when your mind starts to disappear. First of all, your will, your intention, your doing, that's the next thing you throw out. You don't do anything. You give up control completely. And that's when you go very high in meditation. That's what you let go of. That's what you throw away. I'll talk about that later in my talk on Anatta coming soon. But the next way of letting go is called freedom. Do you want to be free? Isn't the Dhamma a taste of freedom? But people don't know what freedom is. The way I understood what freedom is and how I explain it to people is one of my famous stories, which you've probably heard, but I'm going to tell it again anyway. One of my monks was teaching in a high security jail. As he was teaching in that jail, he became very friendly with the prisoners. So one day the prisoners asked him to stay, they gave him some tea. And when they were talking informally, they asked him, "What is it like in your monastery in Australia?" "We have to get up 4 o'clock in the morning, but it's voluntary, it's optional, you can always get up earlier if you want to," said the monk. "Most of the time we don't have any breakfast," he said. "Only if we have to work really hard." "What? They don't give you breakfast? We always get breakfast in prison. And we don't have to work that hard. Sometimes you have to work mixing concrete and building, and it's so hard work. And then we get our one meal of the day." "Only one meal? And it's all mixed together in the same bowl. So we get ice cream on top of spaghetti. We get custard on curry." "That's disgusting," they said. "Even in prison, they give you separate plates. And then we have to go back to our rooms and meditate all day. Can you watch the TV? No TV. Any radio? No radio. CD player? No. Any sex? Absolutely not. Sports? No. That's terrible. Then what do? You have a dinner in the evening? Maybe a cup of tea and one piece of cheese? That's all they give you? You get a 3-course meal in the evening. Then what do? Then you sit on the hard floor meditating, watching your breath all night until you go to sleep on the floor. You don't even have beds? No. That's terrible, they said. That's worse than prison. That's disgusting. We can't allow our friend to live like that, they said. And one of them said, why don't you come in here and stay with us? They actually said that. They invited the monk to stay in jail. Out of compassion. Because it was more comfortable. And it's true. Our monastery is much more harsh physically than a prison. I think even probably in Malaysia, I'm not sure whether... I think you still get 3 meals a day in prison, do you? Yes, much better than my monastery. So why is it, I thought, that in my monastery there is a waiting list, monks trying to get in? Why is it? I'm in big trouble when I go back, because when I go back in the new year, there's an ordination coming up in January. I don't know what to do because there's too many people want to ordain, haven't got enough huts. Got too many monks. Do you want to run a few spare monks? These are young monks still in training. Why is it that people in my monastery don't want to escape? Why is it in these comfortable monasteries in Australia, if people got half the chance, they want to escape? Why is it a prison? Why is my monastery a place of freedom? And I soon figured out, and this is very insightful, the difference between freedom and being in a prison does not depend on how you're feeling, painful or pleasant, on how comfortable it is or how uncomfortable it is. Any place you don't want to be is called prison. No matter how comfortable it is, if you don't want to be there, you are in jail. Any place where you're happy to be, any place of contentment, is a place of freedom. Even if it is austere, if you're happy to be there, you are free. That is the meaning of freedom. Contentment. Now, if the Dhamma has only got one taste, the taste of freedom, are you experiencing the Dhamma in your meditation? Are you content to be with your sleepy mind? Are you content to be with your restless mind? Are you content just to be with your pain? Or do you want to be somewhere else? If you want to be somewhere else, you have just put yourself in prison. If you're with a partner, your husband, wife, you don't want to be in that relationship. Your relationship feels like a prison. How can you escape from that prison? Don't think to change your husband or swap your wife. That's not the way to escape from the prison you made of your relationship. The way to escape is not changing the outside. It's being content with the person you're with. Then you feel free. You're not in jail anymore. You don't have to climb over the walls of a prison to be free. You just have to be content to be there. And then freedom is yours. Now, what I mean in your meditation, if you're content to be here, content to be in your sleepy mind, in your restless mind, in your tired, your sloppy meditation, you've been meditating for 30, 40 years, you've never got anywhere. If you're content just to be here, you're free. And you'll find boom, 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 jhana, enlightenment, very quickly. Because it's freedom. You're letting go. And that freedom, contentment, builds, 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 builds. And all of the things which make your mind move, which separate you from enlightenment, are taken away. Contentment is letting go. Now, this is a powerful teaching for all you meditators here. Any moment in your meditation, if you have a moment of contentment, your mind may be all over the place, restless, tired, think, be content. I mean really content. This is good enough. And you'll find all those problems start to evaporate. When you build freedom, the mind lets go. When you give the mind freedom, there's no need for any thoughts. All thoughts begin from discontent. Because you're not happy to be here, you start thinking of the future, the past, fantasies, dreams, anything. Why? Because you're not content to be here. You want to be somewhere else. That's why the mind moves. I've seen couples, husbands and wives, been married for years. They don't speak to each other. Not because they've had an argument. Because they're so content in each other's company, they know what each other needs. They don't need to speak. Contentment is a great source of silence, both in a family and in your mind. If you're really content, the mind becomes still. So that's the third way of letting go. Real contentment, being happy to be here, no matter what you're experiencing. Then you're free. And the mind stops. And the last way of letting go is non-attachment, which what I say is like having a Teflon mind. Nothing sticks to it. Someone coughs next to you, as soon as the cough disappears, there's no residue left at all. Usually what happens in meditation retreats, the person next to you coughs, and so I'm going to tell them off when I next speak to this person. I was just about to get enlightened, and they coughed, they spoiled it all. Ah. So, a Teflon mind means as soon as the disturbance is finished, there's nothing left in the mind, nothing echoes. The past never echoes in the present. Nothing sticks to your mind. When nothing sticks to your mind, there's no past. You're free of so much. Everything disappears. It slips off your mind until there's nothing left. So those are the four ways of letting go. What those four ways again is giving, expecting nothing back in return. You give to your meditation. You give to this moment. Don't expect anything at all. You throw away whatever you can. Any attachment, anything which is clinging to you, you see it, you throw it away. Throw away time, throw away thought, these two little imps inside you, having this stupid conversation. Throw away, what else, body. Don't concern about your body. Throw away your mind. The whole lot. Check it away. Then you go, high, high, high. Be content. This is good enough. That's actually a mantra which some of the monks use. This is good enough. This is good enough. This is good enough. You are good enough. This retreat is good enough. Your mind is good enough. Your meditation is good enough. There's no more craving left. This is good enough. When you start that technique, your mind gets more and more peaceful, more and more still, more and more bright, more and more brilliant. Nimittas come up. Nimitta comes up. This is good enough. It will become brighter. Non-attachment, non-grasping. This is good enough. Contentment. Well, lastly, having a mind which is a Teflon mind. Nothing sticks. Even what I said now, you don't remember. Nothing sticks. Why are you putting more junk in your mind? I'm telling you to empty out. After a talk, you put your head down, get all that stuff out. So you're free. It's just the underlying things which I've said this evening, that's what's most important. You're supposed to be up two types of meditation. Those of you who are still confused about samatha vipassana, are they the same, are they different? This is the usual simile I give. Two people walking up a mountain. One is walking up the mountain to see the view. You get a great view from on top of the mountain. The second person is walking up the mountain for the peace and quiet. Because on the top of the mountain, it's a long way away from the traffic, from the city. They're going up there for the peace. One's going up for the view, the other one's going up for the peace. Just like in meditation, some people think they're going to meditate for the insight, the view. Some people think they're going up there for the calm, the peace. But the person who's going up there for the view, when they go up to the top of the mountain, they experience the peace. The person who's going up there for the peace, when they go to the top of the mountain, they'll see the view. Because on top of the mountain, peace and the view exist side by side. You can't separate them. In the same way, a person who thinks they're doing vipassana or insight, they'll get calm. The person who thinks they're just doing calm, they'll get insight. The two always go together. And I can always quote the Anapanasati Sutta. It's actually part of the Satipatthana Sutta, the Mahasatipatthana. In the Anapanasati Sutta, the Buddha said, if you fulfill the meditation on the breath, you fulfill the four Satipatthanas. He's saying, if you do Anapanasati, do breath meditation, that is Satipatthana. Calm is insight. Insight is calm. And that makes it so wonderful. We don't have to argue which is the better, calm or insight. I'm a calm meditator. Well, that's what I'm an insight meditator. Well, I'm a calm. They're the same. So you can be friends. Which is important. It's actually, someone might emphasize calm, but they do insight. They might emphasize insight, but they do calm. I've been around long enough to see that. That's why I respect all methods of meditation. So if you want to do insight meditation this retreat, fine. Because I know you're doing calm. If you don't want to do calm meditation on this retreat, fine. I know you're doing insight. They're the same. But the point is, the underlying letting go, contentment, peace, seeing things as they truly are, this is what the meditation is all about. And this is what leads you into the deep seeing, the peace, the bliss, which is the goal of this meditation retreat. So, there we go. The two types of meditation, battling or making peace. Which one do you want to do? Are you a soldier or are you a Buddhist? Okay, any questions? Questions or comments on this evening's talk or anything else? Oh my God, I told it the story yesterday. If you want to be intelligent in your next life, you better ask a question quick. Because death, you don't know when you're going to die. Death can happen any time. So you better ask a question quickly, some of you. Any comments or questions about the talk, about anything else? My goodness, you must be so enlightened. So yes, we have a question. Thank you. Ah, yes. Oh, my favourite questioner. Yes, that's me. Okay, reverse psychology. Yeah, go on, you've got another question. Yeah. Ah, you got me there. No, because it's not really a lie, because because when you say to your son, don't go to the temple, don't go to the temple, or you say to your husband, you get a Dhamma book, or you get a CD, you tell your husband, don't you listen to this. It's not really a lie, because you know, he's the one who's sort of not doing a, doing what you're told, but you realize that that's your main aim anyway, to actually to, if you tell your husband, don't listen to this CD, don't read this book, of course, he's bound to read your book. That's the reverse psychology, which I'm saying. It's not really a lie. I'm not telling a false thing. There's a bit of deceit, I must agree. But it's compassionate deceit. For the sake of the book. And it really works. Many people have tried this because, you know, sometimes that, you know, you may be really interested in Dhamma and your partner isn't. And I've done this many times. There's this woman, in Perth, an Australian woman, she loved coming to our centre and listening to the talks and doing meditation, but her husband thought this was just a lot of old rubbish. Religion is just for the gullible, he would say. And no matter what she said, he just wouldn't listen. So I told her, take a few of the CDs, take a couple of the books, leave them around the house. Do not tell him to read them. Do not even invite him to listen to the CDs, just leave them around. It's obvious, it's curiosity, inquisitiveness. It happened after a few weeks, he wondered, what's my wife up to? And he started reading one of the books. Now he comes every week. It works. So that's the psychology which you must use. Okay, I think you've got me there. You got another one? Oh my goodness, I mean. Now you see, that's my reverse psychology worked with you. I said you got me, I didn't really mean it, but I made you feel guilty. It worked. Ha ha ha. Okay, any questions? Monks are very sneaky, be careful. No questions? Okay, let's call it a night then. So those of you who've come all this way to actually listen to a talk, there'll be another talk tonight. What am I talking about tomorrow night? I think mindfulness tomorrow night. See, tomorrow night's talk, for those of you interested, is mindfulness empowering your mind. So those of you who want a powerful mind, come tomorrow night for mindfulness. Yeah, we got. Okay, shall we share merits? That's the thing good. Actually, you know, because there's so many people here, I think I forbid you from coming tomorrow night. The trouble with reverse psychology, when you tell everybody what it means, it doesn't work anymore. Okay, let's do a sharing of merit. This is for all beings, the devas, relations, everybody else. We do the Idang Mei.
Idang Mei Nyati Nang Ho Tu Sukhita Hon Tu Yatayo. Idang Mei Nyati Nang Ho Tu Sukhita hontu yatayo, idam me nyatinang hotu, sukhita hontu yatayo.
May all sentient beings, invisible otherwise, please partake of the merits which we made today. And all those meditators today, meditating is huge merit. Keeping your precepts, offering dana, listening to the Dhamma, may all our relations and people who aren't our relations please partake of these merits today.
Sadhu, 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 sadhu.
Okay, so please drive safely home. That's not reverse psychology. I want you to drive safely home. And I'm happy to see you tomorrow. Good night. And the meditators here, you've got another half an hour, it's 9:30. If you've got energy, you can meditate some more. If you're really tired, you can go and have an early night.